So off the bat, I want to get your thoughts about North Carolina moving into phase 2.5.
Phase 2.5, woohoo. You know, they had been talking for a long time that they wanted to see the positivity rate on tests down in like the 5 to 6% range. And we're not there yet. Like, right? Like, I just checked for yesterday and we're at 7 point some. And, you know, a lot of it is college kids, you know, all those kids on campuses. That is kind of bumping it up. I asked the secretary that on Thursday, you know, and she said, well, you know, we're holding steady. It's a little higher than I would want. But, you know, we're going to ease restrictions carefully. So that means no bars. Right, which they really worry would be great places to spread things around. I think they are moving, I hesitate to say faster than Secretary Cohen would probably want, but I think at this point in time, you know, there's just so much pressure to open up that I think they had to move. I really think they had to move. She said, we don't see perfection in our metrics. We still know our cases are too high. We know that our percent positive is higher than we want it to be. And she used that as a reason why they're launching this new public service campaign around using your masks.
Yes, the state has launched a big Get Behind the Mask media campaign. So going forward, I want to know, what are you watching out for other than more clusters on college campuses?
I think it's a lot of wait and see. I am very curious about how the flu season pans out, right? I don't know about you. I'm getting a flu shot. you know, and I wonder if the flu season could be one of two things that, one, more people go get flu shots because they don't want to be confounding, like, do I have COVID? Do I have flu? Right. But the flip side of that is also, I wonder, like, if more people are wearing masks and people aren't hanging out together, maybe this flu season will be a little milder, right? Or it won't spread as widely. So, you know, I think I've mentioned that I have a neighbor who's a pulmonologist at UNC, and he and I were talking about flu season, and he told me he was very worried. You know, what he told me, and this was disturbing, he was like, during flu season, our ICU is full of people on ventilators. That's without COVID. Yeah, that was definitely a whoa moment.
Yeah. Well, also happening this week, lawmakers hammered out the rest of the coronavirus funding package. You were there. You have a really interesting article on two items that didn't make it into the package.
I had written a story for Tuesday, sort of a curtain raiser for this short session, and, you know, went through listening to, you know, in great detail to a couple meetings that the Health and Human Services folks had with Secretary Cohen and others from the department about what they would need going forward, right? And they had a whole spreadsheet of, you know, what their priorities were. And then this bill came out, and I sort of compared the bill to the spreadsheet. I was like, and I'm writing next to things like, nope, nope. Okay, less money. You know, so it was interesting, and it was sort of classic, sort of back to form at the legislature, which is that they hammered out the actual bill behind closed doors. You had to kind of be in the know to know where the bill actually was. So all the sort of politicos in Raleigh knew where to look. There was a press conference on Tuesday and where they said, here's the bill, right? 54 pages where you're having to kind of quickly go through and read everything. And then they were done by Thursday, like zoop. And the process that they use is what's called a gut and amend, where instead of like launching a whole new bill that's got to go through committees and, you know, goes through committees in the House, House passes it in 3 votes. Then it goes through committees in the Senate. Senate passes in 3 votes, and then they have to reconcile it, right? No. This, with gut and amend, you can take a pre-existing law, strip out language, and then drop in the new legislative language. So they took this bill that was originally 6 pages and dropped in 48 more pages of language. And then you only, you know, and so the House did that. So that's the House's amendment. It goes to the Senate. So there's only one opportunity to make any amendments, to get any input. And let me tell you, all the advocates in Raleigh, their phones were heating up with all the calls that they were making on Wednesday to try and get amendments into that bill. And then the only place they could really amend it was on the Senate floor. And so there were about 10 or 12 amendments around on the Senate floor. Some of them were, you know, from Democrats, some from Republicans. A couple of the Democratic amendments were just tabled, which is a procedural order that means that, you know, someone gets up and says, I move that we table this amendment. They vote on that motion because, of course, Republicans have the majority. They always win those votes. And then you just have to stop talking about the amendment and moves on. So there were a couple of aspects of the bill that folks were calling me about. I was one of the folks who was on the receiving end of these phone calls, like, oh my gosh, like there was a provision in that bill which would have made it easier for adult care home owners who've had track records of penalties, non-compliance with rules, even deaths in their facilities. It would have made it easier for them to get relicensed. There were also concerns about childcare rules, right? Like, because all these families are like, what am I going to do with my kids? I've got to go to work. Where are my kids going to go in order to do remote learning? So there's places like the Y and Boys and Girls Clubs, and those are pretty well established, but there's also these kind of like neighborhood pods, and they don't have cleaning regimens. They don't have someone on staff who knows CPR or first aid. There's a bunch of things that like the child care advocates were concerned about. You know, these are temporary waivers to those rules. So you can say, it's just for like 3 or 4 months. It'll be fine. But the flip side of it is that, you know, it's for 3 or 4 months. It's, you know, people worried, like, could these waivers become permanent? So it's really interesting to be on the receiving ends of these phone calls. It's one of those cases where, like, I'm trying to write the story and my phone is still buzzing with people calling me to weigh in. On both sides of this, it was actually Senator Van Dyne ran that amendment to tighten up some of those rules around the child care, ad hoc child care centers. And that was one of the amendments that was tabled.
Okay, we're going to wrap up with a look at an article that just hit your website, spotlighting a conversation by some researchers who are wondering, is it time to reconsider bans on using prisoners in medical trials like the vaccine trials, COVID-19 vaccine trials currently underway across the country?
It's a fascinating question as to whether we should allow inmates to be part of a vaccine trial. In the past, inmates were used as guinea pigs and had a lot of negative outcomes in some fairly notorious drug trials. And so now there's a federal rule that says you can't use inmates in drug trials. But like, this is a population that they are acquiring COVID at an incredibly high rate because they're living congregately. I mean, we ran a story earlier or last week that looked at what was happening in the Pitt County Jail. And, you know, like they had 27 men in one dormitory and they basically all got sick because they just didn't have enough space in between them. The face masks came late, you know, so it's a perfect population to study a vaccine, right? But is there coercion? Can you really have informed consent when you don't have freedom? I mean, like, there's a lot of really thorny questions there. So it's a fascinating question. As one of the people in the story said, it's a million landmines to try to work this out.